from Portland, Oregon. This is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rockney Roll. Coming up this episode, as the Gregorian calendar has rolled over a year, the podcast episode counter at the Jewish Review's offices has rolled over past 50 episodes. To celebrate this round number milestone, I've gone back and assembled some of my favorite clips from our first 50 episodes. These selections run the gamut of subjects we've covered on the pod. Some are from our most popular episodes, and some are deep cuts from the early days that, at least in my opinion, deserve another chance in the spotlight. They're all worth your time, so please, stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. The Jewish Review wants to hear from you. We're launching our first ever reader survey, asking you about what you want the future of local Jewish community journalism to look like. Find the link to our brief survey in the episode notes or visit jewishportland.org/Jewish Review to make your voice heard today. We'll start our best of episode with Dr. Rick Hodes. Dr. Hodes is the medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee's Ethiopia Spine and Heart Project, where he's treated more than 1,000 spinal deformity patients over the last 13 years. This segment of our interview starts with his role in Operation Solomon, the airlifting of more than 14,000 Ethiopian Jews to Israel in 1991. I'll let him tell the story. Here's Dr. Rick Hodes.
So I worked in Ethiopia for 2.5 years. I left. I came back in late 1990 to work with JDC, and I was the medical director. So I was in charge of the health of all the Ethiopian immigrants to Israel at the time. We had about 15,000 people or so in May of 1990 when Operation Solomon came along. And I remember walking across the lobby of the Hilton Hotel and running into Uri Lubrani, the Israeli liaison to the Ethiopian government. And he called me over and he said, "Rick, we just got the green light. Tomorrow's the day. Everybody's leaving." So that night we were up late at night putting together the last details of Operation Solomon and what to expect medically and what medicine we needed and so on. The next morning, I got up, and they called together a group that they called the committee. The committee was like the 20 most educated people in this population of 15,000, and they may have had some high school education. They said, "Go to every house, tell everybody to drop everything, come to the Israeli embassy, bring only any medical records that you might have at home or x-rays, because people would take those home, and your own kids. Like, no suitcases." And the next morning, all these people started coming to the embassy. My job that day was getting people out of the hospital. So I had all of these people who had been hospitalized in various hospitals in the city, and I needed to get them out and get them to the Israeli embassy so that they could leave and get to Israel.
So you were medically in charge of, like, you were the doctor in charge of these thousands of people that were...
Right. So we had our medical program. The Israelis had their, you know, they were flying in, they flew in 39 planes. Each plane had a staff, including, I'm sure they had doctors in every plane. But my job was getting people out of the hospital, and people knew me and they knew our program. So that was my job during the...
That's quite the caseload for a doctor.
Yeah, it is. It is. And for example, I remember somebody had an appendicitis. The question is, should we put them in the hospital here in Ethiopia and get the appendix taken out? Or should we put them on a plane and just get them to Israel and hope for the best? And I decided to just give them antibiotics, put them on the plane, and let the Israelis, you know, write a medical note and let the Israelis deal with this. And pregnancy as well. I mean, and it was so stressful. On a typical day, we would have one baby born. And those days, I think we were, that day, I think we had like 8 women gave birth that day because of the whole stress of the situation.
Yeah, I've seen the stories of women who gave birth in the air.
Some women actually did give birth on the airplanes.
But the appendicitis is quite the case. Just write a little note. "Hey, when this guy gets here, take his appendix out, would you?"
I know, exactly.
I suspect you've been asked plenty of times how your faith, your Judaism, has influenced your medical practice. I want to turn the question around the other way. How has your work in medicine influenced your outlook on Judaism and your personal faith?
That's an interesting question. Wow. Being a doctor is who I am. Being a Jew is who I am. So my challenge as a human being is to combine those two, because they're both like 24-hour assignments. Like the way in my life, you know, in Ethiopia, I'm like a doctor all the time and a Jew all the time. And people see me that way. I remember I was going to Gondar, and I went to the nuns, and I said to the nuns in Addis Ababa, I'm going to be in Gondar tomorrow. Do you want me to bring anything to the nuns in Gondar? And they said, yeah, here's some money for them, and here's their mail. So I went, and I delivered them, and the nun looked at me. She said, oh, it's you. And I said, they didn't tell you Dr. Rick was coming? They said, no, they didn't tell me your name. They just said the Jewish doctor is coming. So the nuns, they're not quite sure of my name, but they call me the Jewish doctor. And I'm cognizant of that.
So those two parts of your identity are intrinsically enmeshed.
For sure. For sure.
Our listeners can't see it, but you are wearing an impeccably patterned blue and sea green blazer that apparently has quite a story about it behind it. Can you tell me about your jacket?
Yeah, this is actually Australian Aboriginal material. And I was in Australia a year ago and picked up a bunch of material. So two of my Ethiopian sons are the same size as me. And between us, we have about 40 blazers. I have a tailor in Bangkok who's very creative and puts together, like in this case, the material comes in squares. So they had to sew together the squares and then make a jacket out of it. And they're like magicians. They're so good at it. And so I get my material from either Ghana in West Africa, where we have a hospital that we work with, or anywhere else that has interesting material. And then they turn it into a jacket in Bangkok. So it ends up getting a lot of frequent flyer miles.
What are some of the other noteworthy pieces in that collection?
Oh, I have a lot of African material. Mm-hmm. So some of it on the subtle side, some of it quite loud. Because in West Africa, they love these loud colors. And if you walk around West Africa, they just love, or even just being at the airport in Africa, you see the West Africans wearing these very wonderful, colorful things.
Fabulous. So as a parting question, what is the biggest thing that listeners to this podcast, American Jews and Americans in general, should know about what's going on in Ethiopia from your perspective?
So Ethiopia is 120 million people. It is the second most populous country in Africa after Nigeria. It's large. It's complex. There are multiple ethnic groups. There are multiple challenges. There's a dam, which Ethiopians support and which the rest of the world may not. There are political issues going on in the country for sure. But the Ethiopian people are wonderful people, and they're caring, they're compassionate, they're very good to kids. And I think that there's a great opportunity to do good work. And what we're doing is we're able to take, like before I came to Ethiopia, nobody was looking at spines at all. Now we've done over 1,500 spine surgeries. We've transformed the lives of these suffering kids. And now because of that, we want to build a spine center. We want to keep on going and train Ethiopians so that this can continue indefinitely. That's my challenge, for me to keep on going and to promote this. And I would encourage your listeners to go to my website, rickhodes.org, to read about our work, to contribute to our work. Come visit us if you like. We'd be happy to have you. Come for Shabbat. And thank you so much for the chance to tell my story.
You can hear my full interview with Dr. Hodes in the third episode of our first season, and learn more about his work at rickhodes.org. We'll skip ahead now to my interview with Rabbi Moti Wilhelm, who appeared on an episode marking the 30th yahrzeit of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of blessed memory, better known simply as the Rebbe. Rabbi Schneerson grew the Chabad movement into the force of Jewish life it is today by sending emissaries to Jewish communities around the world, two of whom were Rabbi Wilhelm's parents. He relays the story of their arrival in Oregon and how it's emblematic of the urgency of Chabad's work. Here's Rabbi Moti Wilhelm.
So 1984, my parents are sent over here. And of course, we always tell the story how my parents at that time were living in Australia temporarily after they were married. They're in Australia. They're on an assignment there, which is going to be a three-year assignment. And about 2.5 years in, they come back and they spend the holidays with the Rebbe. This was like the holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, Sukkot. And they ask the Rebbe's office for an assignment. They want a permanent assignment. And it's a little back and forth. They're assigned to the state of Oregon. And at that time, my father comes into the Rebbe's chief secretary. His name was Rabbi Chadakov. And he says, congratulations, you've been assigned to the state of Oregon. And he says in Yiddish, he says, well, when are you planning to move out? And my father says, well, we're planning to go back to Australia, finish our term there. And in a couple of months around Passover time, we're going to move Melbourne, Portland. And he tells my father, he says, well, Efshar Hastunish Farshtanin, perhaps you didn't understand something. He says, imagine you call the fire department and you say, well, there's a fire. And they say, well, in 6 months, we have somebody to come to the fire. He says, there are Jewish children in Portland who don't yet have a Jewish education. You need to go there and you need to take care of those kids. And he says, call your friends in Australia, let them pack up your bags. And let him meet you in Portland. So shortly thereafter, my parents move here. And 1 year later, the boat from Australia arrives.
So I guess interrupting the narrative of Chabad's growth in Oregon, which I'd like to get to, but I think that that anecdote speaks to the sense of urgency that the Rebbe had for fostering and taking care of Jewish life around the world.
Yes. I think the sense of urgency, exactly like you said, was something that the Rebbe highlighted and brought out. You know, one of the taglines, or one of the slogans almost, that the Rebbe really leaned into, it started with a bunch of kids who had come from camp, from summer camp. And in the summer camp, they made this song, and it was, the theme was, or this, the line was, we want Mashiach now. That was a summer camp song. And I think it was like a play on some other song. Now, kids can say that. But the Rebbe actually really embraced that idea of we want Mashiach now and encouraged that idea. And others found it like shocking, like now. I mean, you're talking to God, you're talking to the Jewish people, the Jewish mission. And the Rebbe himself used this slogan in some of his most esoteric talks, in some of his discourses. And he would conclude them sometimes and he would talk about the idea of now. Because the big idea is that Jewish history is not just a cyclical history. It's a linear history. It's a story of we're going from where the world is, and we're supposed to take it in a certain direction to where the world is supposed to be. And we have to feel that urgency. We have to feel that sense of now. We have to do that now. There isn't time to wait. And we ask God, and we say, we want Mashiach now. We want to move this forward, and we do that with a great sense of urgency, because all of Jewish history, all of history, is waiting for us to move it forward now.
We've marked 30 years since the Rebbe's passing. What do you see in the future of Chabad's work in the next 30 years?
You know, in Chabad, we talk about now. It's hard to think about the next 30 years. But what I see as the now is the question of how do we inspire and connect the Jewish people with their Judaism. And I'll tell a little anecdote. When I was graduating from yeshiva, you know, our class, I kind of saw ourselves as almost like a bridge generation. It seemed like the past was so full of incredible history and stories, and the future would bring something. But the now, it almost seemed kind of boring. And suddenly, over the past couple of years, we have a pandemic that's turned over and completely altered the way that the world works, the way that we think about our world, the dependability of our world. And on the heels of that pandemic, we have this war in Israel that we kind of thought was a thing of the past. I forgot to insert, you know, first came the war in Ukraine, where we, you know, we didn't think that just, you know, cities in Europe were just going to be bombed, and it was back. And now we have the war in Israel. So suddenly, it was one of those moments like that moment, you know, when my grandfather was hit by a car, where I had to lean into myself. And we each had to do this as Jews. We had to say, well, there's the Judaism of our fathers. There's the Judaism of the past. But what about the Judaism of now? And how are we talking to this now? And how are we encouraging the Jewish people, nurturing their faith now, and connecting people with their sense of purpose, their sense of mission, sense of hope, sense of urgency that we are indeed going to bring the world to the place that it's supposed to be? And by the way, I only mentioned the kind of real pandemics and wars that we've seen. But we are going through a crisis of unprecedented questioning of purpose, of mission. Teen suicide rates are really climbing rapidly. A lot of that is because people don't have and aren't connecting with a sense of why. So our work is, and it's important as ever, and perhaps more important. And I think that to move forward, what we're going to do and what has to be done is to reach out and to try to connect more of our people with their teachings, with their Judaism, with that sense of purpose, and empowering them with the ability to be a part of changing the world, to be one of the ambassadors of the future.
I think that's as good an answer to that question as one could hope for.
Thank you.
So, Chabads all over the world have created, are known for creating deeply meaningful experiences for all kinds of Jews. But I want to ask you, what are some of the really meaningful experiences that you've gotten to have as a Chabad rabbi?
You know, one of those, I remember I was putting on tefillin with a fellow. I was still a yeshiva student. And as we're putting on tefillin, he shows me the number on his arm. And it was one of those moments that he was talking to me about not having been connected for a long time and the ability to kind of reconnect him and bring out that sense of connection with the Jewish people, bring out that sense of connection with the history, destiny of the Jewish people. It was just like one of those special moments. I think that I'm fortunate to experience a lot of those moments of connection. For me, I also direct the Gan preschool in the executive role, and watching children engage with their Judaism, teaching children about putting a coin in a tzedakah box. There's everything there. There's the moment of the action that's being done right now, like the Maimonides spoke about, you know, this may be the next action that may tip the world in favor. There's the moment of connection that the child is empowered and knows that they can make a difference, that they're able to do an act of tzedakah. Those are very powerful moments.
I want to go back for a moment. When you say the number on the arm, that's I'm guessing that refers to a tattoo that this gentleman received at a concentration camp,
right,
in the former Nazi Reich.
Yeah. Yes. So he had been a Holocaust survivor. He'd been very detached. He had been questioning his relationship with God for many, many years. And I just had the moment. It was just, I had the opportunity to kind of talk with him and offer him the opportunity to put on tefillin. And we actually did. It was actually, it was outdoors. It was on a street corner. It wasn't in a shul, and it wasn't connected to any life cycle experience or anything. It was just a moment of, you know, excuse me, sir, are you Jewish? And we put on the tefillin there. But years and years of trauma or pain, confusion, suddenly came, kind of melted away as we did that. And it was a very powerful moment.
My full and very engaging conversation with Rabbi Wilhelm can be found in the 20th episode of season one of this podcast. Next, we'll go back to the Pod's early days for my conversation with multifaceted culinary creative force, Sonia Sanford. Food is, of course, central to the Jewish experience, and Sanford articulates that deliciously, on a plate, in her book, and in this interview. It doesn't hurt that our conversation dives into my personal favorite of Jewish foods, challah. Here's Sonia Sanford.
So, of course, I want to take some time to talk about your new book, Braids, Recipes from My Pacific Northwest Jewish Kitchen. We've talked before about how you always wanted to write a cookbook. What made you decide that, all right, this is the time, I'm ready, let's do this?
Well, actually, I started writing the book at the end of 2020 and finished writing the book early 2022. And then it takes time for design and completion and publishing. But I think that it just felt, after the closing of my restaurant, I had a restaurant here in town called Beetroot Market in Delhi. There were so many recipes that I was making in the restaurant that were connecting with people here in Portland. And so many of them were inspired by my grandmother, but also by living here in this place growing up in the Pacific Northwest. And the dream of the deli was to connect to people through these dishes, to connect through these stories that the dishes hold. And so when the deli closed, it felt like it was time to maybe see how I could continue that intention in a different way. And the book was born from that.
So it's really the deli brought to life, and on a much smaller scale, of course, because it's not in a physical space, but it's in people's homes now.
Yeah.
Or will be soon.
Yes. A lot of the recipes are things that we served in the deli. And certainly it's about more than just my experience in the deli. There, like I said, there's recipes of my grandmother's, there's recipes that came after I closed the deli, but it does commemorate that place. And those recipes live on, and the few people who have started to receive their early copies, it's been really heartwarming to hear how it made them feel connected to the deli. Several people from out of state who never got the chance to go said they had the feeling of like, oh, it was like I was there. And that's really exciting.
Yeah. I know this is a tough question, but do you have a favorite recipe from the book, and what is it?
My challah recipe is really my favorite from the book, because challah is really just nothing makes me happier than baking a challah. There's just something so special about the collection of very simple ingredients, you know, flour, water, yeast, eggs, very little goes into the dough, right? And then the way that it puffs up, that it rises, that then you braid it, then this thing emerges from the oven and it's all shiny and golden and gorgeous. I just love the ritual of baking challah. We started this conversation talking about like my Judaism, right? And the rituals that connect me to my Judaism. And the ritual of baking and braiding challah is so central to me. It's like every week I stop and connect to my lineage and connect to something bigger than me. And I'm making something in an effort to also connect, because then the challah shows up on my table, and either it's with my family or with friends, and we break bread, and then there's a new story that emerges from that loaf. And so I guess that's my favorite recipe in general, like in the canon of Jewish food, but also this recipe I spent many, many years developing, you know, and so I've never published it before, as I've told you before, and it's my platonic ideal of challah. It's the kind of challah I want to eat. So I'm really excited to have other people experience it.
It sounds like that process of making challah for you is almost like a cheat code. You get to start Shabbat a little early just by the feelings that come up when you make that.
Yeah, there's that anticipation of Shabbat that comes from making the dough. There's that knowing that soon we're going to step into a different rhythm of the week. Even if you're not Shomer Shabbos, you know, in our home we do honor Shabbat in different ways. And I think it's just so valuable, especially in sort of the chaos of right now, in the chaos of these times, this wisdom that's been imparted to us that's so central to Judaism, that which is to take time to rest and to do it weekly. And in that resting, you're honoring something greater than yourself.
And it makes sense. It makes sense to me that challah would have a certain pride of place, because we associate different Jewish foods with different Jewish holidays. And challah is associated with the most important Jewish holiday of all, Shabbat.
That's right. Yeah.
So what drew you to working in the culinary industry?
That's a big question. So I have always loved cooking and food, and I come from a family of cooks. Every single person in my family knows how to cook and is actually a pretty great cook. I'm so lucky in that way. You know, we're so influenced by both our environments and our own interests. And for me, it was very much a combination of both. Like, I was obsessed with cooking shows from age 5. I would just watch nothing but PBS and then the Food Network. And I would just be so happy to sit in my grandmother's kitchen or my mom's kitchen and just watch them cook, or even my dad cook too. So that was where it started. But because I'm the child of immigrants, it was very honed into me that I should become a doctor or a lawyer. And I'm sure many other Jewish friends have that experience. And so the culinary arts were never considered like a profession. It was just something you did at home. So it took a while for me to sort of find that. But in my mid-20s, my interest in food just kept growing. And through a series of sort of unexpected events, I had been working in film and television, and I met a woman who wrote cookbooks and was a cooking show producer. And I was so interested in her work, and she let me come shadow her and work for her. And I fell in love with the process of making cooking shows and food media. And that led to becoming a personal chef, which led to having a more extended career in food.
What memories do you have of perhaps that first point of intersection between your love of cooking and your Jewish heritage, your background?
I don't think that they can be separated, right? Like, I think especially because so much of my cooking came from my family, so much of my family's cooking was connected to where they came from Ukraine. So many of those dishes are classic Ashkenazi Jewish dishes, and so many of them are made for specific holidays. So again, when I was just cooking what I knew, it was familiar to me. It inherently connected me to my Jewish roots. And then, you know, of course, I've explored in other cuisines. And when I was a personal chef, my clients would always want different things like Thai food or Mexican food or whatever food. And that was your job, is to make what your clients would like. But as I started sort of finding my own voice, my own culinary voice, I realized the stories I wanted to tell were my family's foods and the foods that had meaning to me. And those were all, you know, Jewish and Soviet Jewish.
Many of those in your book, I presume.
Many of those in my book.
You can learn more about Sanford's work and get a copy of Braids at her website, soniasanford.com. And catch my full Hanukkah-themed interview with her in the 6th episode of our first season. Next up are 3 snippets from what I labeled our exit interviews. Cantor Ida Ray Kahana and Rabbis David Kosak and Ariel Stone all departed their posts at congregations Beth Israel, Neve Shalom, and Shir Tikva, respectively, in the summer of 2025. I asked them all the same series of questions about their work and outlook, including, what are your hopes for both your congregation and the broader Jewish community in the coming years? Their answers to that question are presented chronologically as they aired, so here, in order, are Rabbi David Kosak, Cantor Ida Ray Kahana, and Rabbi Ariel Stone.
So if the pendulum has swung, first maybe on religion, but then also will Portland get its mojo back, right, which I certainly hope, then the question is, how does this community build on a felicitous moment in time? And Etret Son, as the tradition would say, people are coming back to religion, but we know in the past they left religion. Why did they leave religion? Because religion became fossilized. It became static. It became self-congratulatory on its forms. So the challenge will be, if we begin to grow again, and we've been very fortunate here. We've grown throughout over the last 10 years, which bucked the national trend. When I came here, I think we had about 750 family units, and we're about 850 in an era where the old line was flat is the new up. So we've been up during those times. So there's always success carries a double-edged sword, and is always really dangerous because it can invite a sort of spiritual complacency. I grew up in the era where American cars were dominant. They stopped investing, and Detroit destroyed itself out of greed and complacency. I'm not saying that that trend is happening here at all. I don't think that is the case. But I know there's always a danger that success makes people sleepy at the wheel, right? So what does that mean? It means, among other things, figuring out radical new approaches to Jewish living that make sense for a 21st century AI-infused sociology. I don't know what it means, right? But I think this is a moment of tremendous opportunity for Neve Shalom and for religious institutions. I think that assuming religious institutions avoid mistakes around the business of houses of worship, meaning if the finances can be kept in check and taken care of during, you know, a difficult time financially for, I mean, it's always a difficult time financially for nonprofits, mm-hmm. but, well, you know, even more so if the structure, the business structure around it can be avoided from going downhill, there's no reason this congregation should not grow, right? And so that's really exciting. And the question always is, what do we do with that growth? The question America, now moving to the America question that you asked, that we always struggle to answer, right? We know that America in many criteria is richer than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the inequities around that richness are really, really big and creating a lot of problems. So how do we distribute all this stuff, this change? How do we take whatever it is that AI can bring and make sure that it's not just a disruptor which puts a lot of people out of jobs, but allows us to move a little bit closer to, you know, Reagan's shining city on the hill, an America that is inspiring and that really does work for everyone? Because, you know, from the progressive era through the early 60s, everyone's boat in America was rising. And then starting mid to late 60s, it's been going the other way nonstop. You can read the book, The Upswing, with lots of charts and graphs all about this. So that's my hope, is that America can figure out again that there's only this one country and collective, that it's always been composed of people from many different walks of life and backgrounds, and that the social contract for America is that the success of all guarantees the success of the individual. So I hope that we can figure that out. We're in a time of tremendous turbulence. We know that our political structures, how politics is done, all of these things are changing at rapid pace. And I hope we can find our way. You know, if anyone who's a student of history knows there's no guarantees that powerful countries remain that way. And I think America, for all of its good and all of its bad, I think that the American experiment still has what to offer the world, let alone its own citizens. So I really hope that with this pendulum swing and readjustment, that we find a way that some middle path that allows all Americans to have more opportunity.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. And change is many things. It can be scary for folks, but it is so necessary and it's exciting. And what I'm seeing, I'll talk about our change over here, of course. What I love about it is that we don't have to fear, because this is not unknown. Cantor Raina Green actually predates us. She was here as a preschool teacher before we even moved to Portland when she was just out of college. So that's such a beautiful connection to see all these grown kids now who will say, well, you were my preschool teacher, and now they're in college, you know. Mm-hmm. So I love that we have these deep roots with our future leaders. It's not like bringing in a stranger. And the same with Rabbi Joseph. As I said, she started with me in 2012. So our new senior rabbi is someone who, you know, she is the rabbi that goes out for coffee with you. She really brought that here, that it is, as I said before, all about deepening relationships, getting to know people one-on-one so that they understand that underneath a big tent, there's really room for each person. So I think she brings so much already and will continue to do so. I have a lot of faith and trust and excitement in our new leaders that are following.
Having interviewed both of them, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. I hope that people will find their way to talking to each other more, not being afraid to tackle some of the big and difficult issues that are swirling around, but to keep always a sense of respect for each other and a love of their Judaism. It's a hard time that we're in. And at the same time, I feel like there can be so much so much possibility. Just in my daily interactions with people, I am continually filled with hope. I am right now getting ready to bat mitzvah 5 adults, ranging in age from late 70s to early 40s, and 5 women who didn't have the opportunity to become benot mitzvah earlier for various reasons. And each one of their stories is so compelling and meaningful. So my hope for this community is that we continue having these community-wide intersections and conversations, things that bring us together that are inspiring and joyful, whether it's a speaker or a musical opportunity. And we have the talent. We have it all right here to make that happen. So that's what I see happening, is that we go outside the walls more and more, as we've been doing, outside the synagogue walls. I plan to continue leading Torah treks, even in retirement, and really explore each other and our Judaism.
I believe that we are on the cusp of a very different understanding and a very different kind of living as Jews.
That is a bold statement.
This is not my idea. I got it from Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who back in the 1980s was already talking about third era Judaism. He pointed out that first era Judaism is understood in terms of the Bible. Second era Judaism is Talmudic, rabbinic. Third era Judaism is what we are on the cusp of. Why? In the same way that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by the Romans made it impossible for biblical Judaism to continue, and it made rabbinic Judaism necessary, rabbinic Judaism has been destroyed by modernity. Most Jews get along just fine without ever consulting with a rabbi. What does it mean then to be Jewish? What does it mean to have a Jewish identity, to gather in Jewish groups? Will there be shuls in the future? Will there be rabbis in the future? You know what? When you're in the middle of a transition, you have no idea. My greatest hope for Shir Tikva and for this Jewish community is that we will stay open despite all the stresses that make us want to circle the wagons, especially now. That we will find a way to keep our hearts open to wherever healthy growth might be taking us as a people. I like the image of the plumb line. It's from the prophet Amos. The plumb line is an ancient way of making sure the wall you're building is actually perpendicular to the ground so that it will be steady. You do it by holding a weighted line on the side of it. It's called a plumb line because it's plumb. It holds straight. I guess plumb isn't just a thing that grows on trees. It's the one with a B on the end. And I like to think of this plumb line as being a way of understanding what is working for the Jewish community and what is off kilter.
So in your view, what is working and what is off kilter?
What is working is being kind to each other, taking care of each other. I hate to sound old school, but al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, 3 things the world depends on, Torah, avodah, and gemilut chasadim, study, learning. Learning, changing one's mind, learning more, learning that one was wrong about something, all the learning. This too is Torah and I need to learn it, said Rabbi Akiba. Avodah, ritual, prayer, the moments that define our lives in meaningful ways in community as Jews, whether that be Friday night potluck at somebody's house, or whether that be Passover Seder, or whatever it might be, if it's a Jewish moment and it has some Jewish content, that is Avodah. And Gemilut Chasadim, which is being kind to each other. I used to think being kind to each other sounded kind of weak until I learned that for Jewish ethics, we take justice for granted, but you can do justice and be a jerk. So we want you to do justice and be nice. So it's a higher standard. We're assuming justice. Mm-hmm. What works for us is when we hold fast to those 3 pillars and we hold them higher than anything else. What doesn't work is when we commit the idolatry of putting something else between us and Hashem, between us and Torah. And right now, that's Israel. As much as I love, as much as I grieve for, as much as my heart breaks for, as much as I am dedicated to, and as much as I love Israel, my people, my country, my homeland, I cannot abide the idea that any American Jew would have the chutzpah to judge any other American Jew and rule them in or out of a community based on how they feel about Israel. Israel is not in the Ten Commandments. Shabbat is. It's not love Israel as you love yourself. It's love the other as you wish to be loved. We have every reason to be very proud and also very grief-stricken over Israel right now. What we don't have the right to do is to use it as a pretext to hate each other.
Or ostracize each other, or...
That's what's not right.
My conversations with these three longtime clerical leaders were all insightful, inspiring, and amusing in turn. They are episodes 19, 20, and 21 of our second season, if you'd like to hear for yourself. Our last selection for this special compilation is a more recent one. It's from my conversation with Dr. Dean Bell of the Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership. Dr. Bell talks a lot about community building, and a presentation he made in Portland on the subject spurred me to dig deeper with him on how to address the challenges that Endeavor faces in our current social climate. Here's Dr. Dean Bell.
A couple decades ago, we thought about community, we typically thought that it was a singular noun and that it meant a very discrete group of people. And what we've learned over a period of time is that we all live in multiple communities at the same time. So there isn't one community, there are lots of communities, and they intersect and interact in really powerful ways. And so that's the first thing that becomes a challenge, is that we have people with very different kinds of views and different ways of engaging and different ways of thinking who are coming together and intersecting in really important ways. So first of all is, how do we think about complexifying the notion of community and then making a community that has borders and boundaries that are open to difference, but that are also sort of porous enough to allow people to come in and out in different kinds of ways. And I'll share with you, our vice president, Dr. Karen Freeman, and I once wrote an article on sort of notions of peoplehood. And we sort of argued that at the end of the day, peoplehood exists because of the diversity of our experiences rather than the singularity of it. And in fact, when we can recognize that there are diverse historical experiences of different people within the Jewish communities and that they bring diverse perspectives, that's actually, we can really create a sense of belonging to something, because people with very different backgrounds can finally see themselves as part of the narrative or part of the narratives in a plural sense. And so how you build community becomes complicated and ongoing, but actually rich and exciting, because it gives you a chance to explore many different ideas and to test boundaries, right? And to have productive conversations. But your note about polarization, I think, is important in this case, because I suppose we've all had our own very specific opinions for many years, but it does feel over the past decade or so that we've moved into a very polarized situation where not only do we have very strong ties to a particular position, but we oftentimes reject out of hand any position that's different than ours. I think that's true in general society and really across the globe. I was just in Germany and I had similar kinds of experiences as well. It's not unique to the Jewish community. It's not unique to the United States, unfortunately. And one of the things that we've learned over time is that polarization is difficult, because you get into a kind of rut in which everything that you read or everything that you look at or everything you think about comes to support the position you have. And very rarely are we open to hearing something that might counterbalance that or offer a different perspective or challenge some of the assumptions that we have. And I suppose one of the ways of combating this polarization is getting ourselves comfortable with difference, with other perspectives, and hearing them through. Again, we might not necessarily agree with them at the end of the day, but hearing them through to understand the perspectives and the assumptions underneath them, and being open to change our own minds, but also open to the fact that other people can change their minds as well. I think what's missing in this polarization today, and it's one of the things we build into a lot of our programs, is a sense of nuance and gray and the complications between the poles. That's really more the interesting work is happening. And that's really where you begin to build community, when you can bring people in to have conversations around a whole host of topics, sometimes difficult topics, but open to hearing and engaging in a sort of collegial kind of way, in a way that is respectful, a way that can be challenging, right, and can ask difficult questions, but is open to real communication. And that sort of resilient listening and that communication are some things that I think we've lost over the years. It's hard to cultivate those kinds of skills, but, you know, we can try to do a bit better of that. And there's some ways that I think about it. later, I'm sure.
Yeah, you mentioned that we've lost some of those skills. It seems to me, and you can tell me if this is borne out in what you've witnessed, because you've got a probably better perspective on this than I do, that when we see those multiple points of identity intersecting, some of the polarization we get is from the sort of deeply held positions we were talking about becoming part of identity. And then when there's friction at those intersections, it becomes less of an ideological exchange and more of a challenge to identity. Is how do we overcome that other than just by acknowledging it and acknowledging its ill effects?
Yeah, a really insightful question, and I think one that's really difficult to engage with. There's obviously, you do need to recognize that that's happening, right? I think that is the first step in having this conversation. But I think the other is really being open to the fact that other people see things in different ways and might have good reasons for that. I think I might have shared it even at the professionals lunch. There's a famous theologian named Raymond Panikkar who has this wonderful image of trains and windows. And he says, imagine you're sitting on a train and you're looking out the window in your particular car and you see the landscape in a very particular way. But the window frames what you see, so you don't actually get to see everything. Somebody a few cars away might actually see a very similar landscape, but might see other parts of it that you can't see. And that's the really interesting question then. We see something that's similar, right? We have something in common, but we might actually see some things that are a little bit different. And if we want to enter into a positive conversation, we have to be open to the fact that someone might in fact have a different view and might see things a little bit differently than we do. And so sometimes I think we end up not giving the benefit of the doubt, and we just assume if they're not seeing it exactly the way we do, they're obviously not seeing it correctly. But in this case, what we know is that there are different shades, there are different ways of seeing, and engaging in those conversations, as you suggested before, asking what people are seeing, what they're thinking, why they have those kinds of approaches is the first step, and being open to realizing that we might not have all the answers ourselves, and that our position might be one of a number of valid positions is sort of the second important part. So I do think it's an ongoing process, and it does require us to practice and to be open in a way that is hard to do in a very quick-moving social media kind of world where you get your news really quickly and you can digest it really fast and you need to worry about it. But I think slowing down and stewing on things and thinking about them in a deep way and being open to the fact that other people have similar experiences but maybe a different perspective is a really important process.
When you mentioned practice, I'm reminded of what my high school band teacher said: practice makes perfect, but nobody's perfect, so why practice? And I think we have the answer because the alternative is really, really not working.
Well, I mean, you know, what I would say that too, I think Judaism has a really strong tradition that there is not necessarily truth and perfection. Our goal is to try to continue to get closer to truth and perfection. And so it is a continual process. One of my favorite poets is Peter Cole. I think I shared a poem from his work when I was in Portland. And the notion is that we can continue to ask ourselves and push ourselves and try to get as close as we can to perfection, but we're not going to succeed in perfection. And what he says, because the title is The Perfect State, that's actually the perfect state, the quest for perfection, the continually asking of questions. That's a really deep Jewish value in many ways. We ask questions and question things all the time. We interpret, you know, constantly. How do we bring those things together in our day-to-day life and in our professional work and do it in a meaningful way, right? Ask ourselves question after question and not just sort of be comfortable with the way that we always do things or the way that we see the world in a particular time.
For anyone interested in overcoming the challenges community faces as a concept, including building a new paradigm for resilience that addresses those very challenges, I can't recommend my conversation with Dr. Bell enough. It's episode 2 of our 3rd season and is available, along with all of our back episodes, on the same platform you're hearing me on right now. You can also find a link to our library at jewishportland.org/jewishreview, where you'll also find the link to our reader survey and, of course, our bi-weekly newspaper. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episodes every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you really want to show your support, your gift to the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland's annual Campaign for Community Needs makes this podcast, our community newspaper, and so much of the work we cover possible. Learn more and make your contribution today at jewishportland.org/give. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. The Jewish Review Podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karon Blau-Rothstein. Assistant editor is Rachel Nelson. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening.
Here's to the next 50 episodes and beyond. And until next time, all the best.